The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Book Club with Richard Flanagan, was recorded at the Tabernacle, London, in September 2015. Here's Chair of the Guardian's Book Club, John Mullen.
Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, stooge to the star, as my wife calls me. And the star's Richard Flanagan. And we're here, of course, to discuss his novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which is still the reigning Man Booker champion. Cup has to be handed over, I think. You better dust it down in a few weeks' time. And I am presuming, this being the Guardian Book Club, that you've all been kind of swatting up, because there's a kind of testing the audience element to this occasion. And I was persuading Richard that actually most of you have actually read the book and will probably know it better than either of us. So I'm going to ask some questions for about 35 minutes, and then I'll give all of you a chance to ask questions. And we thought that maybe we were going to have one or two little readings as we go along, Richard, yeah?
Yep.
So we'll try kind of stitch those in. I mean, I wanted to start, if this is okay, it's a kind of academic's way of starting, I'm afraid, by asking you, because so much, I think, has been said, especially in people's initial reactions to the novel, about the substance of it, the kind of what it's about, and particularly what the episodes about, the sections of the novel about the building of the Burma Railroad are about. I wanted to start instead with sort of asking you a bit about the way it's structured, really, and the shifts, which are sort of at one and the same time very easy to follow, and yet when I listed them, really quite dizzying, of time that you get in the novel. Particularly, I was kind of looking at it again today, and although when I read the first couple of sections, I sort of totally knew what was happening all the time, but after the first part of the novel about Dorrigo's childhood and youth, you go to 1940, then you go to him in old age, and then you go to him in the war, and then you go back to him in old age, and then you go back to his meeting with Amy. And I just wondered sort of whether you had, I suppose, did you have a kind of map of how you were going to do that moving around in time?
Well, thank you, John, and thank you all for coming out. I've just endured that London traffic, which is seems a misnomer, really. It's sort of Flann O'Brien writes somewhere, one beginning and one ending is something I've never quite agreed with, and not particularly in that order. And I come from a place where time isn't chronological, and time doesn't proceed as it seems to here as a railway line stopping at all stations of thought. I grew up in a world where time was circular. There's a beautiful poem by Borges where he writes, "Time is the river that sweeps me along, but I am that river. Time is the tiger that devours me, but I am the tiger. Time is the fire that consumes me, but I am the fire." And it's that sense of time that I grew up with. And it's that sense of time that I try and imbue my novels with. I think we were talking about Tristram Shandy because John began his academic career inspired by that great, wonderful book, and which begins, of course, with The Confusions of Time. I think novels, and when you return to the 18th century novel, you're reminded novels are essentially musical in their composition, not chronological. And so I was very concerned to structure it around musical forms rather than chronological forms. How did I do it? Badly, mostly, and frequently failed. But slowly it came to. But it was never in seeking to make time the structure on which the story would hang.
So when it came, I mean, maybe I could ask you about one particular consequence of what you've just described, which is that sometimes we sort of know about things before they've happened or they get narrated and we already know because of the shifts in time what's going to happen. So we know that he's going to have an affair with Amy before he, you know, when he walks into that hotel, because we've already seen them earlier in the novel in bed together. Or more later on in the novel, we already know about that Darky Gardner's going to be killed, because he's talked about it before we watch the terrible process of that happening. So, I mean, that's a kind of, you know, there are surprises in this novel. To me, when I first read it, there were things I didn't know what was going to happen, but there were quite a lot of things that I knew were going to happen before they happened.
Yeah, I think stories not dependent on the devices of narrative. You know, I worked with a soap opera writer many years ago writing film, and they use every device of narrative. Story is a river that takes you along. Narrative's like a water sprinkler, you know, throwing things up everywhere, cliffhangers, unresolved sort of loves, endless twists and turns. But story is something more fundamental and oddly abstract, and it doesn't matter if certain things are revealed. My first novel was called Death of a River Guide, which rather gave away the conclusion before you'd even got to the first page. I've never really worried about that because I don't think the tension in a story arises from that. Having said that, I do think that story is everything, but story's not dependent on proceeding in that chronological way because it's not really how we understand ourselves or how we understand the world around us. You know, we always have some understanding of an ending, but it's trying to understand how we came to that point that consumes us.
You do make we're allowed to kind of talk about endings and give away endings tonight because everybody here has read the novel twice. And you do take a decision to keep one bit of some bits of information you give in sort of in advance, but you do take a key decision to keep one bit of information back, don't you? Which is what was exactly in that letter that Dorigo gets. It's kind of miraculous he gets a letter, you know, in this hellhole from.
I take your point. I mean, yeah. the plotting is contrived and ridiculous.
But, no.
But then, so too is life. I mean, it's a story I've frequently told, but I met a Japanese guard who'd been the most hated man in my father's prisoner of war camp, and a man who'd been sentenced to death for war crimes and had his sentence commuted to life imprisonment and was subsequently released in a general amnesty. And he was a gentle and gracious old man, and we spoke for about an hour and a half in this taxi office owned by his son in outer suburban Tokyo. And for no clear reason that I can divine even now, I asked him after an hour and a half to slap me, which was the principal form of punishment in the Imperial Japanese Army. And he stood up and coiled his body and crooked his elbow and cupped his hand, and you knew that he knew violence. And on the third blow, the whole room in which we stood started to twist up and down and roll wildly. And I thought, because it had been such a strange meeting for me, I really thought I'd lost my mind. Mm. But in fact, what had happened was a 7.3 Richter scale earthquake had hit Tokyo. and my point here is that, you see, God and life are allowed these marvellous events, but a novelist has to make do with the merely plausible. So we don't have great material, and we do the best we can, and I just hope, as readers, you forgive me.
Well, and that, I mean, apart from that extraordinary meeting, how else did you find out about what it was like to be a Japanese soldier or a Korean sort of auxiliary? Because there's one of the extraordinary things about the novel, and it must have been a sort of, I don't know how early a decision it was that you made, that some of the there's two Japanese characters who are both kind of responsible for the sufferings in different ways of the prisoners of war, from whose point of view we, at least for some of the novels, see things. And then there's also a Korean, I don't know if auxiliary is the right word, but whose perspective we share after the war as he waits to be executed. And when we get those sections, there's a lot in them about what it's like, what it was like to have been trained and to, in the way these men were. I mean, you must have had to go off and do research for that kind of thing.
Well, I did the bare minimum. I'm very indolent by nature. I prefer to sit and daydream at a table than be bothered with, you know, reading histories or interviewing people. I really, apart from the Japanese guards, I interviewed nobody. I read very little. You use a very occasional detail to ground the fabulous, and you use when you really want to describe extraordinary things, you flatten the language, you simplify the sentences. Marquez, he had those dirty little journalist tricks, so that when somebody levitates, they're holding a cup of half-drunk cocoa. And it is the cup of half-drunk cocoa, which is the dirty little journalistic trick to make you feel that this absurd event is possible. I mean, research, not a lot, no. I remember I did a gig in Los Angeles some years ago with a famous nameless American author and about 2,000 earnest Californians, and they asked her how she researched, and it was an exhausting thing listening. it was tremendous, you know, that North American industry to hear it. She set up oral history projects, she had databases, she had filing cards, index back and forth, she had software, she had bands of research assistants. Finally, after geological periods of time, she ended. And she, to a lot of applause. I mean, people loved the fact that it wasn't really fancy that she wrote, but slightly augmented fact. And then the moderator, as they called them there, turned to me and he said, and what do you do for research? And I said, well, you know, I'm Australian, we're a bit lazy, I just make it up. and the terrible thing was, not one of the 2,000 Californians laughed.
No.
And at that point, I longed for the San Andreas Fault to open up.
Well, you're right.
Take me away. But how did I know at the Japanese thought. I mean, I think in the end, the awful truth is with the monstrous, the evil, it is within us all, and it's perhaps even closer to us than the things we'd rather we were, the goodness, love, and so on. And it is the role of the writer to essay the universe within. And in the end, a novelist's role isn't to go out there, it is to go in here and then to seek to achieve a transparency between their words and their soul. That's all they should do.
Are so did you need that conversation with the Japanese former camp guard? Did that make a difference to your book or not?
I think it made a difference to this extent. I felt the enormous sadness of us as human beings when evil has triumphed in a country and everyone is recruited into its terrible maw and made do things that they then have to carry on in their souls forever after. Because when I met with these men, I never felt that I was sitting there, standing there with evil. I felt I was with people who didn't feel guilt, because guilt is a more abstract intellectual idea, and it's difficult for the Japanese to feel guilty when the Americans, when every act during the war was an expression of the emperor's will, and then the decision was made to keep the emperor. But I felt they felt something more fundamental, more human, more inescapable, and more terrible, and that is shame. They felt the deepest human shame, and they did want some form of atonement. There was another guard I met at the site of a slave labour camp 60 kilometres south of Hiroshima, where my father had ended up at war's end working in a coal mine under the inland sea. He was a very short man. He was about 92, and there was media there that day wanting to film us and photograph us. And they wanted a shot of me and this guard, ex-guard Mr. Sato, with our arms around each other. It was a very cold day. And we put our arms around each other, and then they'd finished with the photographs and the TV crew had stopped filming, and I dropped my arm. And he, in the manner of a child who craves something, just curled into me and continued to hold me. And he held me for a very long time, perhaps half a minute. And these things are inexplicable, strange. And when they happen to you, you just feel... you feel that when you write about these people, you must write about them in the fullness of their humanity. It was important to me that this not be a book about victims, because if you only write from the perspective of one side, you create an idea of victimhood, which is in the end an idea of moral superiority, and then you've already started going to that place of wickedness where you're proposing an idea of some people being superior to other people, and then that's when the paths and roads begin to open to things like the death railway, to Auschwitz, to ISIS.
So right from the beginning, you were always going to have lots of different points of view, including those of the captors and those who were meting out the violence, as well as...
Because I felt otherwise, it wouldn't be true to what we are as human beings. And to achieve it, I didn't know how I might realise this ambition. I knew it was much more likely to fail than to succeed. But I thought if I could open the book up to the influences, the styles, the techniques, as I understood them, of Japanese literature, that this might help me. Because I'm no expert on Japanese writing, but I have a great love for it. And I felt that... their literature was what was best for me, or one of the great achievements of Japanese culture, one of the highest expressions of it. And the death railway and the crimes the extensive crimes of Japanese militarism in the 1940s was one of the lowest points of Japanese culture, and I thought if I could open myself to what was best about this society and use it to try and help me divine what was worst, that then I might escape judgment. Because if the novel was written in a spirit of judgment and prosecution, it was going to be a failure. That much I knew.
But the guy who quotes most often, I think, from Basho, who provides haikus and who provides the title of your novel, is actually the most appalling character, in a way, in the whole novel. Kota, the guy who's obsessed with executing people, beheading people. And he's the man who sort of has little bits of poetry on his lips sometimes, isn't he?
Well, I think we have... There's a terrible idea abroad, particularly in countries like Britain and particularly in English language culture, that derives from the extraordinary effect the vernacular versions of the Bible had, that vernacular literature is a moral guide, a moral grammar, that it offers guidance how to live. But literature cannot do that. Mm. It doesn't do that. It is of life and part of life, and therefore it cannot escape life. And that all it can do is remind us of the chaos at the heart of things, and in that chaos remind us that we're not alone. But it is a mistake to confuse it with morality. It exists beyond morality. But I think because we live in this great tradition that begins with the Wycliffe Bible, there's always been a confusion and a desire, and you see it most strongly in America, where you can never be forgiven for not having redemption in a novel.
Hmm.
That the novel must conform to ideas of the Christian story. But literature is a different thing, again. Literature is life, not religion.
Okay, but I mean, there's something quite apart from all sort of questions of research and research assistance and all that sort of stuff that I wonder who it was. But anyway, that novelist felt that had to be flourished in front of the audience. There's something very special about this novel in terms of its background, in that, as I think almost every description I've ever read in the press of your novel, especially the ones which came in the wake of your winning the Man Booker, in the first sentence would refer to the fact that your father worked on the Burma Railway, and I just sort of I suppose you're probably sick of talking about this, but I mean I don't know very much about this, about whether that gave you sort of insights and information you wouldn't have otherwise had, but also secondly whether that I suppose I would have thought that put you under a kind of heavy obligation of some kind, that you needed to do justice to something that your father had gone through.
I didn't feel a need to write this, but I found it inescapable. I didn't wish to write it. I tried to escape writing it, but to a certain point I realised if I didn't write it, I'd probably never write anything else, and it was this boulder that kept growing within me, that was choking me. Of course, if my father hadn't been a survivor of the death railway, of being a Japanese prisoner of war, I would never have written this book. But I think the confusion, which I'm probably responsible for, is that people think that I grew up with these stories and then I transformed them into a novel. And it wasn't like that at all, because he told stories, lovely stories, comic stories, gentle stories, but they were limited. They weren't an evasion. They were important stories, but there was so much unsaid. And it is in that huge cosmos of the unsaid that I I imbibed of something that came to fundamentally shape me. And I realised at a certain point I was a child of the death railway. I think that the awful truth of great trauma is that there are these wounds visited upon people's souls, and the wound doesn't simply stay with them. It passes through them into others, their families, sometimes their communities, sometimes whole societies. And these experiences are incommunicable because they're so profoundly human. They don't lend themselves easily to conventional stories, to the language we have. And sometimes it falls to others, to the burden of having to communicate the incommunicable. Man survives by his ability to forget, but at a certain point, freedom exists in the space of memory, and you have to go back into the shadows if you were to finally return into the light. There's a beautiful story about Anna Akhmatova standing outside the Lubyanka prison, the KGB prison in Moscow in 1942, waiting to get in to give some food to a son who was imprisoned inside. And it's a Russian winter. There are these, the sort of damned of the earth, the relatives of those who the KGB are going to send to their death or the gulag. And they're all waiting, hoping to get in to see a loved one in this blizzard. And Akhmatova by then is a non-person. Her books have long been pulled out of all the libraries. She's been stripped of all her honours. And a woman behind her recognises who she is, and she asks her, she says, "Are you Anna Akhmatova?" And Akhmatova says, "Yes, I am." And she says, "Can you describe this?" And Akhmatova looks up and down that line of the damned in that horrific blizzard, and she says, "Yes, I can." And I think the artist, there's an idea of the artist that grew up in Europe in the 19th century that is the subject of much of your work, I imagine, of the artist as existing beyond the people, as a romantic hero, above and beyond, closer to the gods. But perhaps the truth is that you exist in the queue of the damned, and your role is simply to bear witness to that suffering.
Well, when you witness that in fiction, I mean, you do, I guess. There are writers who've done this brilliantly before, but you make us look very closely at terrible things in a way that I bumped on the way to the tube earlier today. I bumped into a former student of mine, and I hadn't seen for ages. And after a certain amount of small talk, she saw the book I was holding, and she said, "Oh yes," she said, "isn't that really brilliant but incredibly harrowing book?" And I said, no, it's brilliant because it's harrowing. but you do, like, I know Zola does this as well. You know, you've got to look at things. You've got to look at things which maybe sometimes I almost wanted to flick the page and, you know, skip a paragraph or two, and I didn't. I mean, there is, you know, there's a terrible operation. I mean, which is just awful to read, although it's brilliantly described. I mean, that was part of your purpose, to not to harrow the reader, but to make us actually look at things which were horrible, painful, disgusting.
The world was so recent, writes Marquez at the beginning of 100 Years of Solitude, that all things lacked a name, and in order to show something, it was necessary to point. It's the role of literature to point to what is. It's not. I didn't seek to write something harrowing or tragic or epic or romantic. I simply tried to describe mud, blood, stench.
Shit. There's lots of shit.
Shit. Yeah. Moonlight falling on a hip. And so on, because, you know, we experience, you know, love as the scent of someone's back when they sleep. Death is a strange shuddering hold of breath that fills a room with the emptiness of the universe. We experience these things with our senses, with our nose, with our ears, with our fingers. And only much later do we come to realise they're tragic or erotic or romantic or horrific or harrowing. So I felt the more I simply described and the less I told readers what to think, the better chance I had of conveying what happened. And I should say, your point earlier, how did I research all this? The more I just allowed myself to go to sit at a table and imagine it, the more it was there. I mean, we carry so much more within us than we can ever know, all of us. It was an act of recovery as much as imagination.
Because, you know, most, not just novels written in America, but novels written in Britain and Australia too, have something that I was interested to see this novel doesn't have, which is you get to the end, and you usually get some acknowledgements maybe, and either amongst those or separate is kind of a list of sort of scholarly sources. I mean, this used to be really unusual in novels, but now, in a historical novel, you sort of almost expect it.
Well, I don't see that as a historical novel, by the way. I mean, it's like calling Homer a historical poet or Shakespeare a historical playwright. It's a bad marketing idea that escaped the marketing departments, and now people think it applies to art. It's an absurdity. All novels are contemporary. They just wear a different motley for their purposes. Where were we before that? What was the question?
about you get to the end of the novel and then you get the pages
sources,
which
well,
tell you
it's because it's, of this nonsense that literature and art that fancy that the great truths that we go to for literature can only have validity if we can authenticate them in fact. But the novel is one of the great inventions of the human spirit, and I think it is one of our great aesthetic and intellectual traditions. It isn't about augmenting research with some fictionalisation. It's not. It is something else. It is a tradition that allows us to interrogate and understand the mystery at the heart of ourselves. We, as a species, I mean, I was taught at school that what separates human beings as a species is the thumb, which was one of the most idiotic things, but I learnt that. But really, I think it's our capacity for story. It was the capacity to constantly reconceive the world in a way that joined us, that allowed us to get out of the cave, that allowed us to start creating communities, cities, culture, civilization. And the stories were superstition, religion, nations, politics, science, and so on. And these stories would be useful for a time until the flaws in them became apparent, and then we discarded them and we found other stories. But the form of telling stories that we've devised that seems to me to be the supreme expression of our capacity to divine our being through story is the novel. And I think it is an extraordinary achievement, and it saddens me that we have to put these absurd little insurance notes at the end of our novel just to pretend that they're not novels, that the novel isn't what it is. I find them insulting.
Okay, well, maybe I've not asked you, and I must ask you about, in a way, the other thread of this novel, which is, you'll forgive me for saying love story, for as a shorthand for the complications of Dorigo's relationship with Amy, but with other women as well. I mean, I guess the sort of the strange thing about that, I mean, strange and striking and believable, but is that even before he suffers what he suffers in the war, it feels as if you're telling the story of a man who whose emotions are quite sort of cauterized. I don't know if that's the right word. Who ends up marrying a woman he doesn't really love, even though he's free not to, and I guess the novel leaves it uncertain whether if he had thought Amy was still alive, he would have gone to her or not. But I guess I was the kind of reader who suspected he might not have done, that this is a man whose heart didn't always kind of lead him the way that he wanted to go.
Does yours?
I trained it over the years a bit.
I mean, perhaps the appeal of love stories to us is that they point to the fundamental divide that defines us as human beings, this way we're caught between the mystic echoes of the individual soul that craves freedom and the dictates of the community that demand conformity to ideas and practices that we frequently find objectionable, sometimes wrong, and occasionally evil. And we live our lives trying to walk between these two polarities, and we live in the rubble of that war because it's a war that never ends. I think great love stories in consequence are always subversive because they point to this dilemma at the heart of every human being and this unresolved dilemma. I was conscious that I would write about a darkness, but if you only make art about darkness, you'll fail because as human beings, we're finally creatures of hope and we revolt against a portrait that's simply darkness because it's untrue to what we know about ourselves as human beings.
But you sort of strangle the hope a bit on that front, don't you? Because already early in the novel, we know that the central character, we don't know everything that's going to happen in his relationship with Amy, but we do know that by the time that he's an old and respected man, he's also sees himself as a kind of, well, he's been a philanderer and he sees himself as a man who's moved from one kind of sexual but not particularly important relationship to another, and which has included sort of seducing the wives of his colleagues and people he's known. And that already shapes the way that we see. So it's, you can't have any illusions that this love story, which we then go back to, is going to go anywhere good.
Oh, really? I mean, the point is that he does know love. It doesn't equate to a happy ending. But, I mean, in the end, the only answer we have to politics, to power, to horror, is the love we might know for each other. It's not a full answer. It's not the basis for anything, but it is all we have. And perhaps it is in that spirit that I wrote the book.
Can I ask before I throw it open then just a really specific question about that? When, because again, this is the kind of thing you're not allowed to write about in reviews or any kind of articles in the newspapers because it's all spoilers, but we can talk about it here. When he, near the end of the novel, but not near the end of his life, what is it, sort of 20 years after the end of the war, I think, when he sees Amy again and realises that she's alive and he sees her with two children that he thinks wrongly are hers, and he doesn't make himself known to her, he doesn't accost her. Was that episode, and the romantic reader in a way might be disappointed, although there's a kind of narrative inevitability about it, I think. Was that meeting and his failure to take advantage of it always part of the design?
No. I won't bore you with the story because I've told it too many times, but I wasn't... I stole this story from life. It was a story my parents told me about a Latvian migrant who ended up seeing a wife he thought was dead and having to make the decision,
right.
And he makes the same choice. But when I wrote, and the first thing I ever wrote in the novel was this story. I wrote it on beer coasters in a pub next to the Sydney Harbour Bridge in 2002. And but when I came to rewrite it for the final draft of the novel, I held it off till nearly the end because I didn't know myself what he would do. And I left the possibility open that other things might happen. But it seemed to me true to his character and true to hers and true to their understanding of their love for each other that they would walk on because that's what their love demanded of them. Anything less than that would have been a betrayal of their love. That's how I saw it.
But it also, really brilliantly, it depends a bit on this misunderstanding, doesn't it, that he sees the children with her and he thinks he sees her in them, and therefore he can assume that she's got a marriage and that she's got, and they're her, and that's all wrong, in fact. It's a bit, you know, there's a...
There's another aspect to this. It is that love stories demand death. Love doesn't have rules, but love stories do, and one is that there has to be death. And there has to be death because we understand instinctively the great psychological and spiritual truth of love, which is that we discover eternity in a moment that dies immediately after. Love's always utterly transitory and also transcendent. In story terms, that means you have to have a death. That's why you can never... All the great love stories are great death stories.
Oh, discuss. Well, I think it's time we did discuss. So we've got a couple of microphones. And could we have a little bit more light so that I can see if somebody who it is. There's a gentleman there on the left.
Thank you. I found your description of your meeting with the elderly Japanese guard near Hiroshima very powerful and moving. And I wondered what you thought he was expressing when he turned and held you. Was it guilt? Was it shame? Was he seeking atonement or forgiveness? And the second part of my question is about, I wonder how your novel's been received in Japan or how it's perceived there.
You know, the older I get, the more I think you can only describe what happens to you. I don't know what he thought. I wonder if it was shame, but it's impossible to know. I suspect it was, but it's impossible to know. How has the novel been received in Japan? It's coming out next year. I don't know. My novels have always been popular there. My translator felt it would go well. I mean, Japan is like Britain or Australia, you know. It's got ultra right. It's got hasn't got UKIP, but it's trying, you know. I don't think it's necessarily condemned to a bad reception, but you can never tell what will happen. It's coming out in China and Korea too. You know, I don't know what uses or misuses people might put to it, or whether it will be read as it should be read. I tend to think it will be read in an open spirit. I found Japanese people that I met very open to talking and thinking about these things. My translator felt, I got her to read the final drafts and advise me on them. She felt it was actually very much in the tradition of quite a few Japanese novels that came out in the 50s and early 60s. That's as much as I know.
Okay, there's a gentleman back there, and then could we have the mic? There's a lady in the front row. Please, sir.
Richard, hello there. Would you say a little bit about Tasmania as the a key setting to the story in the narrative, and just expand a bit on that?
Well, Tasmania is an island about the size of Ireland or Sri Lanka that lies 200 or 300 miles south of Australia, and it is in every sense a different country by virtue of its land, its ecology, its history, but which for good reasons organises its affairs as part of a nation state that is Australia. I grew up in that world, and it was a world that was marginal to Australia, which was then marginal to the world. And I grew up with a sense that we were less, and that was a sense that was an oppression. We were still in our souls, a colony. And there were no books, there were no stories for us to divine ourselves. I also initially tried to write in the manner of the great European and American modernists. I wrote about crowds and cities and ennui, and I'd never seen a crowd. I came here to London when I was 24, yeah. And I had a panic attack. I couldn't believe there were so many people who didn't know each other. I slowly came to see that for all its brilliance, the tradition of the novel that I so loved spoke of things that were not of my world, and that equally I still discovered my world through the novels of Kafka, Faulkner, the stories of Borges and Cortazar, and so on and so on. So I simply set out to try and use the concrete details of my world to speak to the universal. That's not really the answer you were after, but I hope it serves. But what can I say? It is my home. That's really everything. And like everyone's home, it has its upsides and its downsides. It's sort of like it's the poorest state in Australia. It's like a beautiful junkie. It always lets you down with bad habits, but you can't help loving it.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about two things you said in the Imagine programme. Can you hear me? One of which was that you felt a sense of optimism after one of your novels, maybe wanting, maybe not. And the other thing that you felt after each novel, I think, a loss or even a diminishing of self. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about both of those things.
I think there's a misconception that writing's a bourgeois career, and you might advance in it as you might a merchant banker in the city, or a doctor or a lawyer, and that you will gain in all things. But it isn't so, you know. It is to be defeated by ever greater things. And it is slowly to sense that you become less, and that with each story there is less of you, till finally perhaps what remains is the carapace of a rather wretched and shallow human being, the best of whom are the stories they've left behind. That noted literato, Elvis, said when he sang he was touched by God, and you don't have to believe in the divine to understand perhaps the best of you, the things you create, and the rest of you slowly becomes less in consequence. The other aspect of your question about hope and optimism, I do, separate of my writing life, I do find as I grow older, I find myself ever more optimistic. I think there's so much beauty in the world, so much beauty in the people around us. And I think that the only problem we have in the present day is not all the problems that beset us, which are great, but the fact that we are encouraged to take our compass from power, which is only ever a source of despair, rather than from ourselves and those around us, the everyday people too easily dismissed as everyday. And if you look at them, you see that again and again the world does go to a better place because of them. And if you look at them, there is so much to celebrate and to find hope for the future in. And I might be a fool for thinking so, but I find it inescapable.
Well, there's a lady here. Oh, and one up here. Okay, we'll get to you next, madam.
First, can I say congratulations for having written such a remarkably wonderful novel. I've read over the years a lot about what happened to people in the Japanese prisoners of war camp, you know, all the horrors that went on. But what I just thought I'd ask if it was based on truth was the bit about the doctor who wouldn't wear a white coat. The guy that that got the American prisoner out of his bed and into that operating room where he was had his organs removed without anaesthetic. Is that true?
Is it true about the vivisection and operation on the American airman?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Wow. Right. Thank you.
Is it? What about that? Is there more particular truth there about that doctor and his?
Oh, I don't know about that. I made that up. Yeah, no idea.
There was actually. There was a book about it quite recently. Actually, coincidentally, that it was published 2 or 3 months ago.
I don't know if you know about Unit 731, but the Japanese had a small army that over many years in Manchukuo, as they called the part of China they occupied, performed on an industrial scale the sort of Joseph Mengele type procedures and torturous operations on thousands, tens of thousands of Chinese prisoners and civilians. Unit 731 bombed cities of 100 and 200,000 with the bubonic plague and so on and so on. So it not only did they do it, it was common.
Lady up there, thank you.
Thank you. I've got a question to ask that I feel a bit reticent about. I enjoyed the novel.
Oh, don't be reticent.
but reading it, I did get a sense that this would make a tremendous film. And I hope it's not an insulting question to ask, did you in any sense write it thinking of it as a film script? And equally, is there a tendency in current writing for novelists to produce works that they hope will get filmed?
I have no idea if there's a tendency or not. I think people welcome the opportunity to have the most expensive ad they'll ever have made for their book. But I don't know how many writers take it seriously. Personally, I find it sad that the measure of worth of a novel is the size of the Hollywood advance and the name of the stars attached, because in the end, a novel is a cosmos, but a film is really a short story that needs an extraordinary amount of technical intervention to keep you interested. And it's film, finally, is a very reactionary and stupid medium, and it's created in a tyranny, and the tyrant is money, whereas books are in the Republic, you know, they're made in the rather crooked and, you know, makeshift Republic of Letters. But all up, I'd rather live in, a rather decaying republic than a shiny tyranny.
You've had the microphone taken away. I was just going to ask you, because I was just going to say, madam, that, it's a really interesting question, because one thing I was thinking as I read the book was, I was thinking those films that I guess most of us have seen about, which are set all or partly in Japanese prisoner of war camps, there's a Bridge on the River Kwai and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and how much better a book can do justice to the terror of these things than a film. Because when you watch the film, you're thinking, I found myself thinking, Alec Guinness doesn't look thin enough. He doesn't look thin. He's done his best, but he doesn't. And you're thinking, you know, and then actually a book can appall you in a way that maybe. So I was sort of wondering how filmable it was. I was wondering how many people in Hollywood might think, oh, this is a bit too terrible, really.
I remember saying Bridge Over the River Kwai as a kid. I didn't realise till I was an adult it was about, you know, the Death Railway. I didn't know. I thought it was just, an invention. And could Hollywood, who knows, who cares, you know, I don't know. It doesn't, you know, I've worked in film and I've enjoyed it. It's like, you know, running out of the scriptorium and heading off with the circus for a year or two. But I just think books are a much more interesting medium because they have a different relationship with their audience. In the end, reading is a more creative and dynamic act than writing. And a book only comes alive in that sacred communion of reading when a reader decides they like the book and grant it the authority of their soul and their history. Why is it, writes Emerson, in every work of genius we recognise our own rejected thoughts? Well, it is because that's simply all the novel does. Calvino says a great book is one to which we return and there is always more. But what he neglects to say is the more is always us, the reader. A film has an entirely different relationship with the audience. It tells you everything. It tells you exactly how they're dressed, what they look like. There's a vast amount of creative brilliance visited upon a film so that you know every aspect of it, but you don't create it in your own mind. And it is that power that is the great power of the novel.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. You said you felt like you tried to escape writing the book and it felt like a boulder growing within you. So now that you've done it, do you find it easier to write?
I do, yeah. I felt finally free and I've almost finished a new novel and I have one after that half written. And there is something about writing now that there's an ease I have that I never had before. So that is a very strange thing. Perhaps it was a necessary catharsis. Perhaps my fear that if I didn't finish it, I would never write again was correct. So yes, I have been able to write more freely.
Yes.
Richard, I read or maybe heard in your interview with Alan Yentob that this book was quite a long time in the making and may have been made up of three books. Am I right in that?
Five.
Five.
But an odd number.
And which were the particular themes of those books that came into the final version?
Well, they had very different forms. The first one was a novel of linked haiku, a terrible idea, terribly written. The second was a haibun, which is the form of the original Narrow Road to the Deep North, the masterpiece written in the 17th century by Matsu Basho. And that's a nature journal describing a journey that combines prose and some poetry. Then I wrote a sort of Odyssean sort of epic in the first person plural. Then I wrote a sort of family epic that spanned a century that had a great long cast. And then finally I hit upon this fifth version. But with each of the other versions, when they failed and didn't work, and people say, how do you know? Well, they're just bad, you know. It's clear that they're sort of rotten books, you know. I would delete the files off the hard drive of my laptop and I still work quite a bit on paper and I would gather those up and burn them because I didn't want them being transplanted. I had to recast the whole thing and rethink it anew and try a new approach that might liberate me. But in the end, with the fifth one, that was returning to that moment when love demands a man seeing this woman he thought dead, demands of him whether he chooses to acknowledge her or walk on. So it was that idea of love finally that liberated me into being able to write the final book.
Apparently you can't actually delete things from a hard drive, somebody told me.
They're there. And a future PhD student will be disassembling your computer to get them. Don't worry. But I'm sure it will happen. Yes, madam.
I wanted to ask about the love story, going back to Dorigo's character. And although I felt I understood the nature of the love with Amy, and when the room was the centre of the world, and later when he goes to Jackie's widow, that her description of love in the room, and yet at the beginning, when he catches the football, and that's the greatest thing that's ever happened, and nothing else will reach to it. And all the time, that overshadowed my understanding of the love. And I wondered whether Dorigo really could get beyond that moment. And I half believed it, but half didn't. And I just wondered whether that was an intentional tension of yours, or whether anyone else shared that feeling of mine.
You've enriched my work. Thank you. I have no idea, you know. I'm a sort of I don't seek to impose themes. I don't seek to understand my characters. In the end, I suspect you can live with another human being as your husband or wife, as your children, as your closest friends for 6 or 7 decades or even more. And when you came to the end of your time, you might think, they were to the end an unknown continent to me. And we hardly know ourselves why we do things, what matters to us, what's important to us. And I think it's a mistake in novels to be consistent, coherent, because lives are not. Novels aren't arguments. You see in some American fiction, this idea that everything has to be totally explained in terms of motivation and characters have to be entirely consistent and the novelist knows everything about a character. But the moment you know everything about character, you've created only a caricature. In the best, wrote Tolstoy, throw a little pepper, and in the worst, a little sugar.
I'm pondering it. Yes. Please, there's two up there. Somebody had their hand up.
I was wondering if that was why you threw the forest fire in, because it seems to show a different Dorigo completely from elsewhere in the book, his relationship with his family, his sort of instincts to just survive. I mean, why did you throw that in when you did?
Because I, as much as anything else, I felt the book was about the many forms of love, that it was about erotic love, married love, familial love, camaraderie love, love of books, and so on, and how all these forms of love are very important to us, and yet they conflict with each other. They offer us no wisdom, no guidance, and yet they define our lives every day and determine and shape us, even when we wish they wouldn't. So it seemed to me necessary to show how much his wife and his family meant to him, even though he'd been a wretched husband and father. These things may not be laudable, but they're not incompatible with what we are as human beings.
I thought it was sort of the least Ella deserved, really. Well, I sort of thought she... I know she tells a bad lie, doesn't she? But
you're very good on plot.
What?
You remembered it all.
Remarkable, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, it was my job, unfortunately.
You know, writers are terrible on plot, and I noticed... I started rereading the Old Testament a few years ago, and there's a grave continuity error in the Book of Books on the first page, because he creates woman on about day five.
Yes, he does it twice.
He does it twice. He rips the rib out on the next page to create her again.
That's been spotted, I think.
Yeah. But God could get away with it. But, I mean, God wasn't a good plotter. That's my point. No writer is. Not even...
The plot of your novel's good. I'm not complaining about it.
I just want to know if Dorrigo... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Dorrigo Evans is based on a real character. Is he your father? And did he have a love affair with Amy? You might have met him.
So did you hear that? So this is... Okay, I shall repeat it. Is Dorrigo Evans based on a real character, perhaps Richard's father? And if so, did he have the relationship?
Well, a relationship with somebody that made in your life...
No, it's becoming a bit of an embarrassment for the family, I've got to say. because the not the least challenge for me was to create a story, and when I decided to have a central character who was completely unlike my father. So in his excesses, I was searching for things that my father was not. My father was a very sweet, gentle family man. And, the idea that old Archie was this pants man is a little bit traumatic for the family. No, he wasn't anything like that. But it is true, in the Australian prisoner of war camps, it was frequently the doctors that became the leaders, and they became... that they were quite extraordinarily courageous in their leadership and selfless in their leadership. But you imagine it would have cast a large burden on them as well.
I think, yes, gentlemen.
my question, I guess, really has two parts. I was interested at the beginning of the talk tonight that you mentioned taking musical form as inspiration for your novel. I found certain moments in the book so heartrending in their timing that it was like a great symphony, I would almost say, like a moment. And one in particular stuck out for me when, after Darkie Gardner's beating, Rooster goes back to his tent and finds the duck egg. I just found that crushing. And I wondered if you might say a few more words about this idea of musical form versus simply chronologic form.
Well, this may sound very odd, but I cannot describe it better to you than this, but I see it as a sort of three-dimensional object, and I hear it, and then I try and render what I see and hear as story and character, as words, but it's not primarily how I understand it. That's very inadequate, I know, and so absurdly abstract that it makes no sense, but I write from feeling above all, but I try and give it structure, because a novel without structure is a jellyfish pretending to be a shark, and a novel must have form or it's nothing. I can't tell you how I do it, but I don't seek to understand it. I just I read and reread and shape and reshape. Flaubert said he liked books that smell of sweat. In that case, mine rather reek, I'd have to say.
Yes, there's a gentleman in the back row.
Just a very short question. Yeah. I was just curious to know whether you could ever imagine having to rewrite a novel five times again.
Oh, well, possibly. I mean, I knew an awful lot about writing novels before I wrote any. And having written a few now, I know nothing, you know. And each one seems to be more difficult than the last. I feel much freer in the writing of them now, but there are always moments when you feel utterly defeated and lost in the writing of them, or certainly I do. So nothing would surprise me. Some come quickly, I write them in a year, some like this, you know, a very long time. But I can say I would hope not. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, when you were writing the book, and given the difference between the Death Railway and the island of Tasmania, did you feel emotionally all-consumed when you were writing the harrowing aspects, or were you able to just, you know, come out of the writing style when you were just doing some every other day-to-day activity?
I think the idea of empathy that's so prevalent in art in this solipsistic age, this idea of trying to you know pretend that you can know what another human being feels, that there's something that I think is very false. And I think Chekhov said you never should mar the page with a tear. So I did not try and empathise with what people were suffering. I tried to see it and describe what I saw. If you compare the way Spielberg shot Schindler's List with the way Polanski shot The Pianist, it's very instructive. Polanski, of course, was a survivor of the ghetto. The key scenes where Spielman, the pianist, is returning from a work gang and the baby's dying in the foreground. But Polanski just shows it all in the wide shot. Spielman just vaguely sees it, keeps walking. That's it. It's just presented very blankly as journalism, as just showing something. Spielberg, any moment of suffering, of torment, he goes into the close-up. But if you think about it, we don't see these things as the close-up. We you know, if we were to walk outside and someone was to be hit by a car, we would see many things, and only over days and weeks and then years of recollection would we slowly come to see it as tragic. Polanski showed great insight in that, and I think that's the way those sort of things should be written about, not with empathy, but seeking to understand exactly what happened and describe it as best you can, as skillfully as you can, as truthfully as you can.
Yeah. I mean, there are great novelists who have cried over their own novels, aren't they? And Dickens did, Hardy did.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So, I know, I mean, I think most people now would sort of not celebrate that side of those writers, but they wrote quite good books while they were doing it. Yes, madam.
Let me say, I was really moved by your book because...
Can you switch the microphone on? Sorry.
Yes. Wait,
if you say it, I'll repeat it so people at the back can hear.
About his experiences, yes. Well, thank you for that. Just apropos of novelists crying and that, I was thinking... of the axiom of Somerset Maugham's, where he said there are only three rules for writing a novel. The problem is no one can remember them. And look, in his last few years, I often went and talked to him. But I talked to him about just very concrete things, about what a rotting shin bone smelt like. What did starvation feel like inside your mind? How did it affect your throat? What were the feelings you had when your bare foot was cut by limestone and you knew there was a good chance that would become a tropical ulcer and lead to amputation and possibly death? It was just very simple, real things about daily life. And what was intriguing for me was, although he had very good recall, he was slowly distilling his whole experience into this sort of poem of love, really, for the people he'd been with. And near the end, he no longer remembered the beatings or the mud or any of the awful things that had haunted him. And finally, when I got back from Japan and he rang me within a few hours of my return and asked what had happened, and I told him I'd met these guards, including this man, the Lizard, who'd been the Ivan the Terrible of his camp, and how all of them had, asked me to convey their apologies to my father for all that he'd suffered and all that his comrades had suffered. And I told him I felt these apologies were genuine and meant. And my father suddenly said he had to go, which was unlike him, and he hung up. And his mind was still very good. He was 98 and his recall was still very good. But later that day, he lost all recollection of his 3.5 years as a Japanese prisoner of war. And it was, as one of my sisters said, as though he were finally free. So I did talk to him, and but there was much he couldn't tell me, because I think the thing about memory is that we have an idea of memory since the war as an act of testament, and that is fundamentally important. But we shouldn't forget also that it's an act of creation, and we're faced with choices whether we remember it in a destructive way or a positive way, and that's a very human struggle that people have been through these things are tested by.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions. I should tell you that Richard has told me that if all goes to plan, this is the last time he's ever going to discuss this book in public. just to goad you a little bit, madam.
You referred to the burden of leadership. One of the aspects of Dorrigo that I recognised was he feels that he's a sham when he's in being the person that the soldier that they all respect and love. And I think later in his life he still again feels as if he's a sham. And I just wonder if you would say something about that. I mean, do you think that every good person feels that, or that it's just, I mean, that's part of his burden?
So can I just, I think the first part of your question got a bit lost. But, so I think the lady was just asking, for those of you at back, about Dorrigo's feeling that he was a sham. Everybody thinks he's a good guy, he's a good man, he's doing good, but he seems, is this what you're asking about? And whether this is a kind of common feature of people that others see as virtuous. He hates the idea of virtue, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. I think he says somewhere that virtue is vanity dressed up and waiting for applause. I think he understands that we live by illusions and stories, and that he's been condemned to be jailed in this particular illusion of the courageous leader, a man who feels there's nothing courageous at all about him. But he understands that if he doesn't play that role, they're all doomed. And so he accepts it, and he accepts the duty that goes with it for the rest of his life. But he feels only ever unequal and guilty for all the people who've died because of his decisions, and he's shamed by that. I think, finally, fame is a form of incomprehension, and he understands his fate is to be alone and misunderstood all his life. But he also understands that was necessary. I wanted to describe a character who understands that he only lives through others, that he exists in how they perceive him, and that he has to accept that. So that was that's how I perceived him. I think it's true of many people who find themselves in those situations.
We got one more question. I think we have. The last question that Richard Flanagan will ever be asked about the narrow road to the deep north. Not the last one he'll be asked, but the last one he'll ever answer.
Yeah.
It's a very light question. It's about the fish tank in the Greek restaurant.
Yeah.
I wondered where your inspiration for that came from. Was it based on a truth?
It's a true story. I grew up with the story of the beating of death of my father's best friend, a man called Mickey Hallam, who was beaten to death in the manner that the character called Darkie Gardner is in the novel. And after the war, half a dozen of the survivors gathered in a pub in Hobart, and they went and smashed the glass of this fish shop and freed the fish. Where my story differs is they go back the next night and apologise. But and so must I, because that's the end. That's the end of me ever talking about this book. Thank you. You've been wonderful. And thank you very much. And thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I should just say it's brilliant that we ended with a sort of perfect an epitome of the sort of triumph, the superiority of fiction to fact in that little episode, and what was in truth and what wasn't. And Richard thanked you. I thank you all for your questions, but I'm sure that you'd like me officially, as it were, to thank him for being such a great guest.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.